On the show today, the U.S. Secretary of State meets with China's president.
Well, his message was that China is wrong in thinking that the United States is embarked in an effort to contain China, and particularly on the economic side.
Plus, there's a new film about the Iranian community in Los Angeles and their reaction to the anti-government protests in Iran.
It charts the California community's attempt to help their people from afar, spreading the message of freedom.
And later, a submersible taking wealthy tourists to see the wreckage of the Titanic is missing at sea, and the tragedy in the waters for Ukraine's dolphins. Today is Tuesday, June 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in downtown Washington, I'm Steve Karish. The latest on the massacre in Uganda in a few moments. First, though, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Chinese President Xi Jinping in Beijing on Monday. After the meeting, Blinken spoke with reporters.
We are clear-eyed about the challenges posed by the PRC. The United States will advance a vision for the future that we share with so many others, a free, open, stable, and prosperous world, with countries upholding and updating the rules-based order that has, for years, safeguarded peace and security globally. To shape that future, we start with diplomacy, including with China.
The meeting with President Xi came on the second and final day of Blinken's visit to Beijing, aimed at stabilizing relations between the two powers. For more on the visit, I'm joined by Daniel Russell. He is Vice President for International Security and Diplomacy at the Asia Society Policy Institute. He previously served as the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. We reached him in New York. What was Secretary Blinken looking for when he went to Beijing?
He's made it pretty clear, Steve, that his goal for the meeting was to reopen the blocked channels of basic communication between the U.S. and China, and that he wanted to also dispel some misperceptions, as he put it, about what America's strategy and intent were with respect to the region and with respect to the bilateral relationship. And frankly, I think he was able to realize those two goals.
Well, what are the misconceptions?
Well, his message was that China is wrong in thinking that the United States is embarked in an effort to contain China, and particularly on the economic side, that we are committed to a policy of decoupling. He makes the distinction, which he says is very important, between decoupling, which we're not doing, and diversifying or de-risking. In other words, the U.S. and the Biden administration want to safeguard American intellectual property, have reliable supply chains, but trade between the United States and China, Blinken pointed out, has actually gone up, not down. And so decoupling is a misperception.
And how did the Chinese react to him saying this?
Well, it's hard to know on the substance how they responded, but more broadly speaking, they were constructive in their engagement with Blinken. After all, no U.S. Secretary of State had visited for more than 5 years. That's pretty serious.
Now, it was all smiles and handshakes in front of the cameras. And as you said, people say they expressed their goals and they were warmly received. There still are some major differences, particularly around treatment of the Uyghurs, human rights, and Taiwan. How do we see those issues going forward?
Well, Steve, this was not a visit to resolve the very fundamental and very difficult issues in the U.S.-China relationship. There are areas that the two sides categorically disagree on, and both Blinken and his Chinese host, I think, conveyed their resolve to defend what each of them perceives as their national security, their economic interests, their core interests, so to speak. But at the same time, they both said, and I think Xi Jinping explicitly said, that he seeks a sound and steady U.S.-China relationship. The watchword of the meetings was stabilization. Stabilize the relationship, make it more predictable, and make it more constructive. I don't think that it was all smiles and handshake. I think there was a lot of tough discussion about those significant areas of concern. In the press readout from the meeting with Foreign Affairs Committee Director Wang Yi, the Chinese side criticized the U.S. sharply for what they call hyping the China threat. And Secretary Blinken, for his part, in his press conference at the U.S. Embassy, made it very clear that he had raised a host of concerns and issues ranging from human rights to Taiwan to the detention and exit bans on American citizens.
Danny Russell is vice president of the Asia Society Policy Institute. He's also former assistant secretary of state for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. Mr. Russell, thank you for your analysis today.
My pleasure, Steve.
U.S. President Joe Biden appears happy with how the meetings in Beijing went, telling reporters Monday evening that progress has been made. A vessel taking people to see the wreckage of the Titanic has gone missing. That story in a few moments. Now, police in Uganda say they've arrested 20 suspected collaborators of the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF. That's the group believed responsible for killing 42 people at a school in Mpondwe in western Uganda last Friday. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Addressing journalists at the Naguru Police Headquarters in Kampala, police spokesperson Fred Enanga revealed security personnel had arrested 20 suspected collaborators of the Allied Democratic Forces rebels, the ADF, are militants with ties to the Islamic State group. This comes as Uganda's armed forces continue to pursue the rebels in the areas of the Rwenzururu Mountains and into the Democratic Republic of Congo's Virunga National Park.
We also have the head teacher and the director of school. As part of our inquiries, they need to give us answers to certain questions.
The suspected ADF rebels attacked the Lubiriha Secondary School in Mpondwe Kasese District Friday night, killing 42 people, including 37 students. According to the police, the attackers set fire to the boys' dormitory and attacked the girls with machetes. The burned bodies of 17 male students were recovered. Six people survived with injuries and are being treated in different hospitals in the country. Even though 25 bodies have so far been examined and identified, only 23 have been handed over to families for burial. The student victims ranged in age from 12 to 25. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
American and Canadian ships and planes are searching for a submersible that went missing more than a day ago in the mid-Atlantic Ocean, about 700 kilometers south of St. John's, Newfoundland, while taking tourists to explore the wreckage of the Titanic. The U.S. Coast Guard said there was one pilot and four passengers on board, and that the vessel has the capacity to stay submerged for 96 hours. However, it's unclear whether it is still underwater or if it's surfaced and is unable to communicate. The AP's Julie Walker has more.
Canadian officials say the five-person submersible was reported overdue Sunday night about 435 miles south of St. John's, Newfoundland. And that search is being led by the U.S. and Canadian Coast Guards. In a statement, OceanGate Expeditions confirmed the search for its five-person submersible and said its focus was on those aboard the vessel and their families. The company has been running the tours to the wreckage of the Titanic since 2021. And when it started, they were charging around $150,000. I'm Julie Walker.
And here's some of the other stories we're following from around the world. A global aid agency warned on Monday that a large-scale plague of locusts is ravaging northern Afghanistan and could destroy 1.2 million metric tons of wheat, almost 25% of the country's annual harvest. A Tunisian judge has barred radio and television news programs from covering the cases of prominent opposition figures accused of conspiring against state security. And the Chateau of Versailles will reopen the private rooms of Queen Marie Antoinette as part of its ongoing 400th anniversary celebrations. The restored rooms will reopen to the public on Tuesday, allowing tourists to see where France's final queen played with her children and met with friends. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of scientists led by researchers at the University of Toronto has found a new way to specifically target and eliminate a major threat to our food supply without harming the environment. A pesticide with the research team's newly discovered chemical compound called Selectivin targets plant parasitic nematodes, or PPNs. PPNs are tiny and almost invisible worms that kill plants and cause what some experts estimate to be $77 billion of crop damage each year. In a University of Toronto release, only 7 nematicides have been developed in recent years, but their use has been mostly restricted or banned in many countries because of the harm they can cause to people and plants. As a result, farmers were left without an effective way to fight these destructive pests. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
It's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Parrish in Washington. Russia's war in Ukraine is tragic not only for the people there, but also for marine life. We'll find out more in a few moments. First, the story of a new film that charts the response of the large Iranian community in Los Angeles to the brutal crackdown on anti-government protests in Iran. As Henry Ridgewell reports from Paris, Iranian communities around the world are coming together to try to help their countrymen and women.
It's known as Little Tehran. Tens of thousands of people of Iranian descent live in and around Los Angeles, the largest community outside Iran itself. A new film, titled Los Angeles, Capital of the Iranian Opposition, captures their response to Iran's brutal crackdown on recent anti-government protests. It charts the California community's attempt to help their people from afar, spreading the message of freedom. Among the community leaders featured in the film is Sudi Farouknia.
You know, where there was always this glimpse of hope that there might be a possibility of some sort of a reform, that things can get a little bit better. That dream is gone. Everyone knows that that's not going to happen. So they really don't see us as being the leaders of this movement, for sure not. But they do understand that we are amplifying their voices.
Director Sylvie Delul presented the documentary at the Dissident Club in Paris, a self-styled meeting place for political exiles and Parisians.
The people are very proud of what is happening in Iran. They are really positive, and they know that everything will change. They don't know how, but they know that nothing can be as it was.
The screening was followed by a debate on how the global Iranian diaspora can help those being repressed in Iran. Among the audience was Chloe, of Iranian descent, who did not want to give her family name.
Our first mission for the diaspora is to carry the Iranian people's voice throughout here in Europe, to make them heard first, to mobilize people also, and to truly mention what is going on in Iran.
In response to the death of Mahsa Amini in Iranian police custody in September, Chloe and fellow Iranians set up a movement in Paris called Femme Azadi, or Free Woman. They stage regular protests outside the Iranian embassy.
People are moving towards our cause, but the decision makers are not there yet. So I'm calling upon them to react and to make the choice of not supporting this horrendous regime.
Chloe, like many of the Iranian diaspora, feels she cannot go back to Iran while the current regime is in power. She says the brutality of the government crackdown has united the global Iranian diaspora, and they are determined to help bring freedom to Iran. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Paris.
The United Nations says two-thirds of refugees around the world have lived in foreign countries for more than 5 years because of protracted crises in their home country. The media tend to focus on the recently displaced. So to mark World Refugee Day, VOA is taking a look at what hope there is for refugees who appear destined to live large portions of their lives without access to work and services because of their refugee status. Henry Wilkins reports from Jemena, Chad.
Mohamed Jumaz Ekrier is a refugee from Sudan. He fled the war in Darfur to neighboring Chad when he was about 5 years old. Educated in a refugee camp, his academic abilities meant he was granted a scholarship to attend college in Chad's capital, Jemena. Back then, he thought he had a bright future. Now, Ekrier feels his hopes of a better life have been dashed.
Yeah, exactly. If you are a refugee student and you graduated from universities, it is so difficult to get the job here. I don't want to lose my ambitions.
Refugees in Chad do not have the right to work. Despite being among the country's brightest, Ekrier is confined to a life of continued academia, as he sees it, and is now a research student, receiving barely enough pay to live. In the Garga refugee camp where Ekrier lived his early life, refugees who have been here for nearly 20 years prepare food to feed refugees displaced days earlier by Sudan's new conflict. One new arrival to Garga told VOA,
I came yesterday here from Darfur. I want to return to my country one day, but now it's not feasible because of the war.
Yet she too is likely to end up a refugee living for many years in Chad. While the media tends to focus on refugees displaced by new crises, the UN says most refugees globally live outside their home countries for more than 5 years. Experts say efforts to find durable solutions to this situation are being stepped up in some countries. The Kenyan government announced in May it will give its Dadaab refugee camp, which has existed for more than 30 years and is now home to around 300,000 people, municipality status, allowing refugees some rights to work.
Kenya is a very interesting case because I think the huge Dadaab camp that they have is one of the most notorious on earth, or has been. And the Kenyan government has been pretty innovative in trying to find different solutions. They already started trying this years ago in Kalobeyi. They started to set up what they call the settlement approach. So it's the idea not to create a camp, but in a way to create a city.
Experts say despite the evidence that allowing refugees to work benefits the economy of host countries, they are slow to give refugees access to the economy for political reasons.
But in reality, we often see that, I would argue, for populist political reasons, you still see these divisions being kept up, and you still see sort of that, foreign populations, migrant populations, and particularly refugees, are seen as threats for public security, are seen as a burden for the economy.
As for Ekrier, like so many refugees, he feels his life is about little more than surviving, not living. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Jemena, Chad.
The environmental impact of Russia's war on Ukraine is devastating. Ukrainian scientists say that new research shows that sonar signals from warships are partially responsible for the deaths of up to 50,000 dolphins. Irina Shankarenko has more in this report narrated for us by Anna Rice.
Since the first days of Russia's war in Ukraine, scientists say dead dolphins have been washing ashore on Black Sea beaches in Turkey, Bulgaria, Romania, and Ukraine itself. Ruslan Strelets is the Minister of Environmental Protection and Natural Resources of Ukraine.
Some 150 dead dolphins have been found on Ukrainian territory alone. And according to unofficial data, according to some experts, these numbers reached a few thousand.
Ukrainian officials say it's hard to give a full estimate of how many dolphins have died due to the war. But biologist Ivan Rusev with the Tuzlivsky Limani National Nature Park says the numbers appear to be alarmingly high.
We believe some 50,000 cetaceans have died during the active phase of the war.
Rusev says sonar signals from military ships in the area are partly to blame.
The powerful sonar signals affect the auditory communication system dolphins use, so they end up basically blind, unable to tell where to go, what's around them, and where to get food.
Professor Greg Glass from the University of Florida expressed concern about how many dolphins are dying.
And the fact that we've seen such a huge increase, since the onslaught that began, suggests some serious issues going on caused by the war itself.
Ivan Rusev says exploding mines are also a problem.
Never have scientists witnessed that many shell-shocked dolphins in the Black Sea. There are hundreds. They live for a few days, then die.
Ukrainian officials say saving dolphins while fighting is going on is next to impossible, but Ukrainian scientists are hoping to create a special rehabilitation center for the animals after the war is over. For Irina Shankarenko, NRI's VOA News.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, visit us online at voanews.com and follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has called for the release of unjustly detained Iranian prisoner Vahid Afkari. Vahid is the brother of champion Iranian wrestler Navid Afkari, who was executed in secret by Iranian authorities in 2020 in what the United States called an unconscionable act. Navid and Vahid, as well as a third brother, Habib, were arrested in 2018 after peacefully joining protests in their hometown of Shiraz. The demonstrations at the time erupted over economic issues and expanded to protest the regime's repressive rule. Navid Afkari was tortured to confess to crimes he did not commit and was subjected to a grossly unfair trial. Vahid and Habib Afkari were sentenced to decades in prison. Habib was released in March 2022 after spending 550 days in solitary confinement. U.S. State Department Principal Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel noted, Vahid Afkari has now spent 1,000 days in solitary confinement.
Like his brother, Vahid was unjustly detained and tortured into giving false confessions and handed down a 33-year and 9-month prison sentence and 74 lashes after an unfair trial. Vahid's treatment is typical of that of the Islamic Republic's judicial authorities, who are not interested in justice, but who endeavor to strike fear in the hearts of ordinary civilians and protesters.
The demonstrations that took place in Iran in 2017 and 2018 were, up until that time, the largest protests since the Green Revolution of 2009. Both have been surpassed by the nationwide anti-regime protests that followed the September 2022 death in police custody of 22-year-old Kurdish-Iranian Mahsal Amini. Tens of thousands of people were arrested in those protests. The U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control has imposed 11 rounds of sanctions actions targeting the Iranian regime and its security elements and officials involved in the crackdown on peaceful demonstrations since September 2022. Spokesperson Patel said, "We'll continue to take steps to hold the Iranian regime accountable for its egregious human rights abuses." Meanwhile, he said, "The United States wants to draw attention to the case of Vahid Afkari. We once again call on Iranian authorities to free Vahid and all those Iranians, including many young people who remain imprisoned for exercising their human rights, including the right to freedom of expression."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.